afternoon. This is the professor, Dr. Ron Daniels, president of the Institute of the Black World 21st Century and distinguished lecturer emeritus from York College, City University of New York. Welcome you to this October 25th edition of Vantage Point, COVID-era edition of Vantage Point. Here on 99.5 FM, that's WBAI on the Pacifica Network in collaboration with YCRadio.org. Running a couple of minutes late, hope we will catch up soon. We'll be listening to Dr. Shango Blake, who'll be talking about the curriculum of inclusion and what a topic that will be. Also, later on at the bottom of the hour, we have a recorded interview with none other than Ibram X. Kendi, the award-winning author of How to Be an Anti-Racist, New York Times bestseller. So that'll be our show for today, and we hope we have a few minutes left, as we always try to do, for audience input or audience questions and answers, a few minutes at the end of the show. But right now, just want to make a quick announcement while we're waiting to plug in with Dr. Blake. Masked up. That's right. I'm saying it. I know some of y'all don't like it, but I'm saying it. Mask up, backs up. Not just for you, but for others. This is not just about how to save me or myself or I. It's about others, your family, your friends, your relatives, neighbors. Let's collectively work together to kill the virus in order to stop the virus from killing, again, our family and friends and neighbors and whatnot. So we just need that discipline. I know there's a lot of debate going on one way or the other. It's becoming a hotter and hotter issue. I just heard something about the police union talking about not invading their personal something or other and all of that. I'm sympathetic to all of that, except that there is substantial data, credible data by credible messengers, even from our community, which was where I want to hear first, from African Americans who are attesting to the deadliness of these viruses, the COVID viruses and their variants, and the science that is behind them. And so it's not like any ordinary thing out there. This stuff is deadly, and we need to stop it so we can get back to life as reasonably normal. So again, that's just my perspective on on that. Again, today we want to talk about the curriculum of inclusion, which is a major breakthrough that is being discussed, and no one better to discuss that, as I said before, someone that we're immensely proud of, so proud of, is none other than Dr. Shango Blake. Dr. Shango Blake, welcome to Vantage Point.
Thank you, brother. Thank you. I appreciate you, Brother Ron Daniels, for giving me an opportunity to come and speak to your audience. I am honored to be here and ready to answer any questions that you may have about this historic curriculum that is going to be developed in New York City.
But before we do that, again, you've just emerged as someone that many of us are just so proud of. You're doing such a phenomenal job. And I always have to ask this question because I'm interested in why people come to do what they do. And very often people are shy and bashful about doing that. But it's important so others may learn how to be converted as well. So let's get a little background. You know, how or why did you become a social and political activist? Family influences, upbringing, events. Talk to us a little bit about the background of Dr. Shango Blake.
Well, a little bit of both. A little bit of family influence, or I should say major family influence, and then mixed with events. My father is Professor James Blake. He's a longtime activist, educator, who's worked in our community, dedicated his whole life to the improvement of Black people. And has worked both on a citywide level here in New York and a national level. My mother is Dr. Bessie Blake. She works in higher education. And interesting enough, she you know, they have two different approaches to how they lead, but she led with a certain level of quietness, but very revolutionary in terms of changing the face of adult education and empowering black women all across this country. And so, you know, one was a close friend, my father, and an assistant minister to the Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan. And my mother was a close friend and confidant to Rosa Parks. And
oh,
so
wow.
I grew up in a home where I was exposed and actually had the opportunity to talk to these people, meet with them. You don't really understand subconsciously what that does to you and what kind of course that sets you on. But I was able to, at age 9, 10, 11, really drink deep into the minds of these great leaders and then watch directly my parents' activism and their point of view, their worldview, and how they work together, even though there may have been at times different perspectives, there was always mutual respect. And I think that that's impacted and informed, you know, the way that I try to lead. And then when I think about events, I come to this work through my own personal lens of education, transforming low-performing schools and working with young people who I don't call at risk. I remember Dr. Adelaide Sanford says she hates those pejoratives that we put on our children. I come to this work dealing with and representing not the at-risk, but the underestimated. And our children are talented, they're brilliant, but they're often underestimated. And then those who stand up for them are often demonized for representing and supporting black children. And so that was what led to me wanting to get more involved, because I came to understand as a principal that once you really are about educating children, there's no way to do that without becoming a political activist, because there's a system in place that is set up structurally for the destruction and for the undermining of our success, specifically
right.
as it relates to young black and brown children.
Well, that's incredible. That's why, you know, it's so important to get that background out. Of course, I know your father, Dr. James Blake, incredible Professor Blake. He's done so much for so many years. But I had not known about your mother and your mother's role and her relationship to Rosa Parks, or your father's relationship, though I may have somewhere along the line, to the Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan's incredible background. And that's why we like to get that information out in terms of how people get shaped. Now, sometimes that doesn't matter. Some people very often do things different anyway. But in general, in this instance, obviously the fruit has not fallen far from the tree in terms of the work that that you do. You've gained the reputation, by the way, of being the hip hop principal. So talk to us about how that came about.
You know, I laugh because I go into educational environments and I say I'm the hip hop principal, and people always chuckle because they think that those two words, hip hop and principal or education, are in opposition to each other. And they actually are in cooperation to each other if we truly understand the word hip hop, not gangster rap, not trap music, not what is commercialized and put for the masses. But hip hop at its elements was a music that represented the voice of the voiceless, that emerged out of the Bronx when people were being burnt out of their homes and music programs were being taken out of New York City schools. This subculture called hip hop was developed with the five elements of breakdancing, MCing, DJing, graffiti, and knowledge and purpose. And I always say, you know, when you think about, like, even the graffiti, people think, oh, well, that's a quality of life crime. No, it's not. When you think about the people being burned out of their homes and their response was to draw beautiful murals on buildings to beautify their presence, or to draw murals or trains to let the people downtown know that there was a humanity uptown that had been forgotten, then when you think about it in the lens of its social conditions, it's a different point of view and perspective. So I came into the school with the love of hip-hop because I grew up in that era. I grew up listening to the greats like Rakim and Big Daddy Kane and LL Cool J. And so that was my coming of age wonder years. And when I became a principal, I realized the power of hip-hop and its impact on our children, and I wanted to leverage that to improve student outcomes, to change the culture of a failing school, to train teachers around what is now called implicit bias, to get students to celebrate through the music, the concept of academic achievement and success. And the result was that within a two-year period, a school that I walked into that was the worst school in the district became the number one school in reading, math, and science. And hip-hop, although it wasn't the ingredient, it played a key role in terms of the culture and the way that we communicated to the children the urgency of change in our school. And so that's how I became the nation's hip-hop principal.
Well, it's really phenomenal. And by the way, as someone who worked many, many years ago on early African-centered childhood development, we talked about the holistic nature of how to do that, which means that you have to be innovative, you have to be creative in order to do that. Whereas very often a Eurocentric approach is segmented. It is sort of discombobulated, if you know what I mean. It's like little chunks as opposed to looking.
Put in a little compartment.
Yeah, in compartments, that's right. Whereas, you know, if you can learn math through a rap, then learn rap, learn it through a rap, or physics through, you see what I'm saying? You know what I mean? And that is the beauty and brilliance of being able to do what you've done. Now let's get to the curriculum of inclusion. And I never want to take things for granted. So let's do a 101, a basic. What is a curriculum of inclusion?
So this project that is coming to the New York City schools in terms of a curriculum is not called the curriculum of inclusion. It's really part of a broad-based approach to addressing systemic racism in our school. And so it's the Education Equity Action Plan, and its focus is to bring Black studies into the New York City Department of Education to fully integrate it within all subject matters and to make sure that all students, K-12, in New York City schools are introduced like a normal part of curriculum, just like they're introduced to European concepts of world and global history. And so we're excited about it, but I do understand the curriculum of inclusion because of that was a framework that came before us in the late 80s, early 90s. People like Dr. Adelaide Sanford, Dr. Leonard Jeffries were working on a curriculum of inclusion with other scholars from other backgrounds and ethnicities. And during that time, it was a framework to begin to introduce our great history and a history that had not been included in the curriculum. And the political backlash was the commissioner at the time, a gentleman by the name of Mr. Sobel, who was in support of such a curriculum, was fired, and a watered-down version of the curriculum of inclusion emerged, and they called it multicultural education. So we come in alignment with the curriculum of inclusion with this Education Equity Action Plan.
Well, I appreciate you providing that background, and my apologies for and my being in battle fatigue and overloaded still at this late stage of my life and sort of misstating it, actually. But I, you know, we had a conversation and we talked about the relationship between the two and so forth, because in a sense, as you said, in a way, it is almost like the fulfillment of the actual intent of the curriculum inclusion, because it was never intended to be watered down or to be diluted or whatever. And so this is an amazing, amazing development. And it shows really why not only you, but metaphorically you, your generation is so important in terms of picking up the threads, honoring those threads, and building on those threads So that the history of black folks that are moving forward, it's like Dr. Vincent Harding said, there is a river. It is a river flowing. You know, there are obstacles, there are setbacks, but still that river is flowing forward. And now, with the education equity action plan, this is historic. So tell us about the milestone agreement. How did this come about, and will there be funding, and what will the process look like?
Yes, sir. First, I'd like to say there's really no need for apology because in actuality, you're absolutely right. I just want to say that we come into this understanding that we are just trying to be a strong link in the chain. But we understand that there is a chain of events that has led to this moment. And we don't do this without honoring our elders and honoring our ancestors. So even when we talk about the education equity action plan, we can't say that without lifting up the name of Dr. John Henry Clark, Dr. Ben, Dr. Asit Hillard. We understand that there are people who have dedicated their life, Dr. Adelaide Sanford, been committed to making sure that our children receive a healthy knowledge of themselves and what their people have contributed to the world. So I just wanted to say that at first, and then to talk to you about process. The way this came about was that it was a collective group of black educational organizations in the beginning. My organization, Black Edfluencers United, here in New York City, which consists of principals, teachers, parents, community activists who are working in the K-12 space with a clear educational agenda for black children. These are black educators talking up for black children and not allowing others to hijack the narrative of who our children are and who we are as it relates to our children. Organizations like ABNY, which is an association of black educators of New York, one of the oldest black educational organizations in the city of New York. Eagle Academy, which was founded by 100 black men, and allies like United Way and a group called Black Education Research Coalition out of Teachers College. We collectively worked with the Black Latino Asian Caucus of the City Council. We said, this is our agenda. We want black history taught in our schools. And we gave our position paper to the city council. And as a result, they adopted it into a resolution. It started with the Black Latino Asian Caucus. I want to definitely give a shout out to Adrian Adams, who is co-chair of the Black Latino Asian Caucus, council member Adrian Adams and council member I, Danique Miller. We worked them day and night to craft this resolution, which was then pushed from the city council's caucus to the education committee, the education chair, under a gentleman by the name of Mark Traeger, and then ultimately to the speaker of the city council, Corey Johnson, and it was approved in their last fiscal budget. The result of that is that $10 million was earmarked for the development of a commission, not a commission to study whether or not we should have black studies, but a commission to fully implement and roll out a black studies curriculum. And so that was kind of the process. I pointed out, and one of the things that's so critically important to note is that it was powerful to see black educators and black organizations working together in cooperation, not in competition. It was powerful to see black elected officials sitting down with black educators to work together in cooperation, not in competition. We may have our own unique organizational goals, but we understand the power of operational unity, and that's why we were able to get this done. We worked together. We had an agenda. It was not a bunch of people giving an opinion. We were clearly focused on what that agenda was, and we locked in and sacrificed the time to get to this point. And so that's how we got to where we are right now.
And so moving forward, how will it, I guess you sort of answered this question. I guess I want you to sort of repeat it. So what the next step then is the actual putting together the commission, and the commission will then ultimately come up with a plan. Is that the next step?
So let me just tell you about the commission, and this is critically important. The commission will have certain key representation from key stakeholders on the commission. We're looking at content developers and curriculum development experts. That's one group. Then we're looking at our Black historians, our Black activists, who have the knowledge and the history that where we're going left, they can say, no, you gotta go right. This is close, but you gotta look at it from this because this is historically accurate. Then we're going from there to a stakeholder group of principals and teachers on every grade level because we need to know where the gaps are, right? We know that in order for us to roll this out effectively, we have to have at the table at the very beginning those who will be responsible for actually teaching the curriculum. So this will give us information about professional development implications. This will give us information about how we hold people accountable to actually teaching the curriculum. Where do the gaps exist? How does it look in the K to 5 space versus the middle school space versus the high school space? And so a lot of times when people roll out curriculum, they only include individuals at the tail end, and that's why it never fully is rolled out the way the architects thought of it. And then lastly, we must have parents and community groups, community-based organizations, faith-based organizations involved in this process. So we will have stakeholders from each one of these areas that we will invite to the commission as we develop the curriculum. This curriculum is not, because I get this question all the time, well, what does the curriculum look like? It looks like what we're about to create. It has not been developed. It is being developed. There is a timeline for that development this year. There is a timeline to have pilots that will be put in place in New York City to test the curriculum, and then professional development in the spring for a full rollout next school year. So that is the process.
Incredible. And again, very well thought out. And I appreciate you uplifting, again, what are the cardinal principles that I believe, and many of us have believed, is important in terms of moving forward in the Black community. I mean, it's one of the principles that we certainly articulate in terms of the Institute of the Black World 21st Century, in terms of what we call the principles of collaboration. We talk about promoting a culture of collaboration to heal and empower Black families, communities, and nations. And of course, one of the formations that exemplifies that is one which is also very proud of you, and you have been engaged with it through Baba Leonard Dunstan as well as Nana Rosalind Prudhomme, and that's the Black Family Summit, which is also sort of deals with this notion of unity without uniformity, figuring out how we can work together and build together. And every time we can do an example of that, it beats back the disunity, the disorientation, the internal internalized racism that afflicts us. So I'm really, really, really just proud, and again, just so delighted that of this coalition. I know some of the partners, and Denique Miller and Adrian Adams and so forth. Go right ahead.
I'm so glad that you raised Baba Leonard Dunstan and Mama Rosalind Prudhomme. I am so fortunate that I have, the elders around me, and these are the individuals who I seek counsel with. These are the people who help me understand, who help give me context, who keep me centered and grounded. And I just think in our community, what ends up happening is we have this illness that has been put in us since we have been removed from our traditional culture. Slavery has separated the elders from the younger ones, so to speak. And we miss all the jewels and the treasures that are contained in our elders. And then we end up making the same error generation after generation after generation. It is not my job to make the same error. It is my job to make new mistakes. And then the generation that comes behind me to make new mistakes because they've learned from what my success and my failures were. And I get that when I interact with Mama Rosalind and Baba Leonard Yes, I'm part of the Black Family Summit, and that's why I'm so excited to be here to share with my family what we're doing in New York.
Right. Well, finally, we got to get some contact information out in terms of how people who want to support can support. How do people interact and come to be engaged in the various aspects of the work that Dr. Shango Blake is doing?
So you can, I'm going to give you our website for Black Influencers United. It is thebe-u.org. I'll say it again, thebe-u.org. And if you want to get information about how you might want to get involved or participate or be engaged, you can email us at info@thebe-u.org. So that's info@thebe-u.org.
All right. Okay. Well, it's been really, really a pleasure to have you on, my brother. And again, we're so proud of you. We'll look at other opportunities to have a full discussion of this. I was delighted to be on with Brother Fatin Muhammad and others on the open line. Sister Jennifer, when the initial announcement was made, and I said, well, I've got to make sure that you're also on Vantage Point. So it's an interactive, intersecting audience. Many of the people who listen to Open Line also listen to the WBAI, but we cannot tout this enough. We cannot continue to get this information out there, because this is a milestone, a breakthrough, and a serious advance. And we need victories. You know, we need victories.
Yes,
in these troubled, difficult times, we need victories. And this is one of the victories that we can build on in terms of rescuing and restoring the race moving forward. So thank you so much, Dr. Shango Blake, for spending time with us
afternoon. Thank you. It's been my pleasure and honor. And anytime I can come back, I will be honored to. Thank you, sir.
All right. Okay. Thank you so much. Well, again, we'll ask your opinion at the end of the show. We have a few minutes to see whether you think this initiative, I mistakenly, though not really mistakenly, but I've referred to it as a curriculum of inclusion in talking about the show, where really it is an education equity action plan, which will ensure that Black Studies is effectively incorporated into the curriculum of public schools here in the city of New York. And I think that's an amazing development. We now want to turn to a topic that in some ways is similar as we talk about the whole issue of white supremacy and how it's affecting and infecting and has infected these United States of America in this moment of inflection. I had an opportunity last week to actually conduct an interview with someone who does a great deal of work in this area, very, very legendary in that regard, and that is a professor, Dr. Ibram X. Kendi, and of course, his renowned book, among many, which is entitled How to Be an Anti-Racist. So we now want to plug in and listen to the interview, my interview with Professor Kendi. You're listening to WBAI 99.5 FM. This is the professor, and we are honored to have a very special guest this afternoon. None other than Ibram X. Kendi. And I'm telling you, this is very special. Ibram X. Kendi is the Andrew W. Mellon Professor of Humanities at Boston University and the director of the Boston University Center for Anti-Racist Research. Professor Kendi is also a contributing writer at The Atlantic and a CBS News correspondent. He is the author of The Black Campus Movement, Black Students and the Racial Reconstitution of Higher Education, 1965 to 1972, which won the W.E.B. Du Bois Book Prize. He wrote the book Stamped from the Beginning, The Definitive History of Racist Ideas in America, which won the National Book Award for Nonfiction. And of course, the New York Times bestseller, How to Be an Anti-Racist. My brother, welcome to Vantage Point 99.5 FM in New York.
Oh, it's great to be on with the professor. Thank you so much.
Well, I want to jump right into it. But before we, you know, sort of get into the substance of the discussion, I'm always interested in how people become who they are. So I just want to start by asking you, you obviously have become a leading public intellectual and scholar activist. What is it in your background, your upbringing, or the influences that led you to this avocation?
I mean, I would say it's a combination of factors. I would first and foremost say my teachers, my teachers, many of whom came of age in the 60s and, you know, in the 70s, I would say I sort of was trained in journalism. So I learned pretty early on how to write in a way that was accessible to the people. And then coming up in Black studies in a sort of a discipline that's focused on producing scholarship for the liberation of, you know, Black people, I think the combination of, you know, those factors have been critical for me.
And that's important because as one of the people who was, you know, in the trenches helping define this Black studies movement, that's exactly what we had in mind, you know, the whole notion of liberation for education. Using the title of your New York Times bestselling book, How to Be an Anti-Racist, I'm interested in your assessment of the challenges and opportunities of this moment in American history. You talked about the fact that people are coming at you and so forth, but the work that you're doing, it seems to me, is at the epicenter of this critical racial reckoning in America. How do you assess both the opportunities and the challenges of the moment?
The opportunities is that there's a growing clarity among people, including Black people, that there's nothing wrong with Black people and everything wrong with structural racism. And that clarity is then, I think, germinating sort of activism. I think the challenge is that with disinformation, with a whole sort of ecosystem of media that it is really sort of mass manipulating people to imagine that those efforts to dismantle racism are actually racist. I think that's causing just a new generation to be confused, as past generations have certainly been.
So how dangerous is this moment in that regard? You know, back in the day when we were coming along, I was coming along, my generation, we had talked about the dying gas of racism and white supremacy. We really meant it. But it seems now that, you know, with the assault on the Capitol, the insurrection that took place in January 6th, and all of the different manifestations that we're seeing, I mean, this really is kind of the dying gasp, and it seems like it's pretty dangerous.
I mean, it is, and one of the ways to compare it to the 60s is as if, you know, like George Wallace was certainly a governor of Alabama, but when he ran for president from the presidency, he was not able to necessarily win or even get onto, you know, a major party platform. In this age, George Wallace is dominating the Republican Party. And at the same time, you have an astronomical number of people of color who are willing to hold the sort of water for white supremacy. And the benefits and the incentives for those folks to be a Larry Elder or Candace Owens are pretty immense.
Wow. Yeah, it is. It is. It is really, really, really quite an interesting moment. The work that you do, you know, how to become an anti-racist, are you seeing benefits from that in terms of at least getting larger numbers of white folks to embrace the nature of what white supremacy is and acting on it in a way that can contribute to the success of, dare I say, a movement for a more perfect union?
Well, I do think there are many white folks who have recognized that there's really no such thing as a sideline in this struggle. And for too long, they have imagined, well, if they weren't in the Klan or if they weren't Donald Trump, that they were not part of the problem. And I think they're realizing to do nothing is to be complicit in the maintenance of the status quo of inequality and white supremacy. And I think there are more and more white people. Indeed, last summer, a majority of white Americans told a pollster for the first time that racism existed and was a bad problem. So, you know, I do see some movement among white folks, just as at the same time, you know, other white folks are moving further away, you know, and trying to figure out ways to maintain or reestablish white supremacy.
How important is it that the president of the United States, Biden, has really, one might say, have the audacity to actually use the term, you know, white supremacy? He was recently at the anniversary of the dedication of the Martin Luther King Monument, and he, you know, unabashedly, in a way that it would appear even some previous presidents were perhaps hesitant to do, to just say, you know, white supremacy is a threat, white supremacy is a danger. How important is that in terms of this overall struggle that we're engaged in?
I mean, I think that obviously the use of terminology from a president of the United States doesn't necessarily mean white supremacy is eliminated, but how can we even begin to eliminate anything if we can't even name it? You know, and it just sort of embarks on, I think it was in the 1830s when Congress instituted a gag rule that they couldn't even talk about slavery, right? It also, it then took the sort of sails out of the growing abolitionist sort of movement. And so I think certainly naming it is important. Obviously, it's not structural change, but there is some importance in that. And I think that especially the term white supremacy, and to name that, you know, is critical.
You speak about censorship or denying people the right to say these things. I'm wondering, we seem to be at another moment in that regard. I mean, there's a whole movement going across the country. To take a slightly different angle, because I wanted to ask you about your work, but also critical race theory. To what degree do you think, or do you see a connection between critical race theory and the quest for reparations, which is, you know, some of the work that I'm obviously very much involved in, and has exploded to be a very, very crucial movement. So how do you see the kind of work that you're doing, you know, anti-racism work and whatnot, but also the discussion of critical race theory, which is now being said to be taboo? We're not supposed to talk about, you know, these things. I mean, how do you see that connecting to reparations, if at all?
So I think the way that it connects to reparations is that you have those who are currently simultaneously defining critical race theory and opposing it, and in a way that critical race theorists wouldn't recognize, are stating that racism is a thing of the past, that those who talk about racism are the real racists, are stating that the cause of, let's say, the massive racial wealth gap or gaps in poverty or income is the result of what's wrong with Black people. And so I think that ideological sort of process then leads them to think it's heresy for us to propose reparations. And so I think they've created an ideological condition that blames people as opposed to policy and power, and imagines that repair has already happened, and indeed imagines that the people being harmed are white children, you know, as opposed to all of our children if they're not being taught about racism.
Well, finally, what's next? I mean, you've done so much. So what's next for Ibram X. Kendi? What's your next move, brother?
So I just announced the other week that my next book is focused specifically for parents and teachers on, especially in this moment, on how to raise, you know, this children. And so after I wrote How to Be an Anti-Racist, I was constantly bombarded with from teachers and parents and caregivers of children, like, okay, how do I teach this to my kids? Right. you know, how do I ensure that my Black child doesn't think that there's something wrong with them or people like them? How do I ensure that my white child recognizes that they're special when they're kind, but they're not special because they're white? And so I wanted to sort of write on that. So my next book, which isn't coming out till June, but it's called How to Raise an Anti-Racist.
Right. Well, Professor, I just want to thank you so much for taking time out of your incredibly busy schedule to spend some time with us on here on Vantage Point 99.5 FM. That's WBAI in New York on the Pacifica Network. Professor, thank you so much and Godspeed. We certainly need you and we hope to do this again sometime.
You're welcome. Thank you so much, Dr. Daniels, and for all your courageous work, you know, over the years. I we all really appreciate it.
Thank you so much. All right. To our next segment here on WBAI. All right. Well, that was the interview that we did with Professor Ibram X. Kendi, and he is a phenomenal writer, intellectual, just doing incredible work, soft-spoken, really very young brother, but influenced, as he said before, Professor Shango Blake has talked about, by others who came before him and the Black Studies movement and carrying on that tradition, which is so incredibly important. Well, we want to give our audience the opportunity to check in now and to call in to react to what you've heard, particularly in terms of these two topics that are really kind of interrelated. Professor Shango Blake, the hip-hop principal. Yes, sir. What an amazing job he's done. The whole question of educational equity action plan, which is about integrating effectively Black studies into the curriculum of K through 12 here in the city of New York. The question is, what's your opinion about that? Will it work? Will it be helpful if this is reaches fruition? I have no doubt that it will, but we'd like to get your opinion on that particular question. You can call, get right into the conversation at 212-209-2881. That's 212-209-2881. We'll get you into the conversation. The other question is your opinion on the question of how do people become anti-racist? Is this a worthwhile pursuit? Can we really teach people to be anti-racist? Or is this just an exercise in futility? Obviously, Professor Kendi feels otherwise and feels that there's some success along those lines.